Good morning. I invite you to come into this house of worship where your heart may be kindled by joy. Come into the house of the Spirit where the ark bends towards justice.
Come into this house of reason
where our minds see truth wherever it may be. Come now into this moment among these people and know that you are welcome. The flame we kindled this morning came from a small spark, a little light, a big bang, created anew each time we gather, for each and for all.
Nice to see everybody.
So I wanted to talk a little bit more about this stone
soup. There are stories from many cultures about a soup made with a stone. And the one I wanted to tell today comes from Trinidad. In Trinidad, they call this soup that was first made with a stone, they now call it Callaloo soup. And it's a mysterious, curious brew, kind of a thick green stew. That's not the kind we're going to make, though. We'll make minestrone because it's safer. The first Callaloo was made about the times when tall wooden sailing ships were still arriving in the ports of Trinidad. The people who had been living there in the first place weren't quite sure what to make of these ships. They'd never heard of England or France, Spain or Portugal, where these ships came from, and they just kind of retreated into the forest to watch and see what is going on. They didn't know either about China or India, Syria, Venezuela, Ghana, Mali, where some of the people who were on those ships came from. And then just like the Arawak and Carib people who kind of stuck to themselves off in the forest, well, each of those cultural groups, they stuck to themselves too. The Chinese didn't want too much to do with the French, and the Indians didn't want much to do with those Venezuelans. And, well, that's kind of how it was. And the island may have stayed very divisive like that had it not been for a huge storm. It blew in across the Atlantic, and it seemed almost like it picked that island up and dropped it again. Houses were knocked down, boats smashed on the shore, trees fell over, and the crops were flattened. So now all the people were scared and even more guarded. They found some food, they kept it for themselves and their own kind. And so Trinidad may have stayed very divisive like this, except there was an older woman who always had a twinkle in her eye. And one day as she was walking through town and surveying things, she noticed something shiny underneath the wreckage. She got some friends to help her, and they scooped it out, and it was a great big cooking pot. Ah, she thought. And then she had her friends help her gather some of the wreckage to make a pyre so they could set a light. And they put the pot on the pyre, poured in water, and she also had a very beautiful rock. And she said, "I'm going to put this stone into the pot, and we're going to make some soup. It may be a little bit bland, but there'll be plenty here for every child, woman, and man." And she stirred that pot. Her friends had poured in water by now, and it was beginning to simmer a little bit. And everybody thought, "Oh, soup, I'm hungry." Then they thought, "Bland soup? I don't want bland soup." And they started to go back to their homes, and, well, some of the French people returned with garlic and thyme, and some of the Brits returned with salt pork, and, well, the Syrians came with some cumin, and there was an Indian family that arrived with a whole bunch of coconuts, and they cracked them open and poured in the coconut milk, and the woman stirred, and she said, "Well, this soup won't be entirely bland, and there's plenty here for every child, woman, and man." And she kept stirring, and people kept hearing her chant, and more people arrived. The Chinese, they came with the leaves of dasheen. They're dark green leaves that give the soup their color. And the people, even the Arawaks and the Caribs decided to come, and they brought with them coco yams, sweet, delicious vegetables, and coco plums that are tangy as can be. And who else are you thinking about? Who have I forgotten? Oh, well, the woman stirred. She said, "This soup won't be very much bland, and there's plenty here for every child, woman and man." But then she looked around. Where were the children? And it was just then that they all heard them, clattering up from the beach. There were children of every shape and size and color and culture, and they'd been down on the beach working together. They'd been collecting crabs, crabs that would make a delicious addition to the soup. So they stirred those crabs in, and now the woman said, "This soup won't be the least bit bland. You guys can help me. There's plenty here for every child, woman, and man." Well, pretty soon that soup was simmering away, and the woman found a calabash to ladle it out, and people had brought bowls. And pretty soon people were slurping up that soup and starting to feel better. They were getting some good, wholesome food for the first time in a while. Feeling better, they began to chat a little, tell stories, sing songs even. And those children who'd been down on the beach together, they kept chatting across cultures. They kept mingling. And it's said that their children are the first Kalalu children, the children who came from the people who knew how to get along. Some people say that learning to cook Kalalu really is about learning to live. And I would say we all need to be cooking lots of that stone soup. And that's what we're going to do today, our own variation of it, after we leave this place. So if everyone...
Come. Let us enter now into a space of quiet meditation, of thoughtful reflection, of deepest prayer, and chimes. Set your feet firm upon the ground beneath. Close your eyes if that is comfortable for you. I invite you to take a deep breath in and out. Again, in and out. I will offer a sung meditation this morning from the Rabbi Shlomo Karlovac, found in our teal hymnal. Then I will ring the bell, followed by a minute of silence, when I will ring the bell again to welcome you back. Again, a deep breath in and out. Return again, return again. Return to the home of your soul. Return again, return again. Return to the home of your soul. Return to what you are. Return to who you are. Return to where you are, born and reborn again. Return again, return again. Return to the home of your soul. Good morning. I'd like to begin this morning with the words from the American poet, trauma specialist, Jungian psychoanalyst, and the author of Women Who Run with the Wolves, Clarissa Pinkola Estes. She intends it as a letter to young activists, but I am no longer so young, and it sang to me. I hope it will sing to you as well. It is a longer reading, so I invite you to again take a deep breath. Feel your feet firm upon the ground beneath you. Close your eyes as you are comfortable, and hear these words. My friends, do not lose heart. We were made for these times. I have heard from so many recently who are deeply and properly bewildered. They are concerned about affairs in our world now. Ours is a time of almost daily astonishment and often righteous rage over the latest degradations of what matters most to civilized visionary people. You are right in your assessments. The luster and hubris some have aspired to while endorsing acts so heinous against children, elders, everyday people, the poor, the unguarded, the helpless, is breathtaking. Yet I urge you, ask you, gentle you, to please not spend your spirit dry by bewailing these difficult times, especially do not lose hope. Most particularly because the fact is, we were made for these times. Yes, we have been learning, practicing, been in training for, and just waiting to meet on this exact plane of engagement. I grew up on the Great Lakes, recognize a seaworthy vessel when I see one. Regarding awakened souls, there have never been more able vessels in the waters than there are right now across the world. And they are fully provisioned and able to signal one another as never before in the history of humankind. Look out over the prow. There are millions of boats of righteous souls on the waters with you. Even though your veneers may shiver from every wave, I assure you that the long timbers in your prow and rudder come from a greater forest. That long grain lumber is known to withstand storms, to hold together, to hold its own, and to advance regardless. In any dark time, there is a tendency to veer toward fainting over how much is wrong or unmended in the world. Do not focus on that. There is a tendency, too, to fall into being weakened by dwelling on what is beyond your reach, by what cannot yet be. Do not focus there either. That is spending the wind without raising the sails. We are needed. That is all we can know. And though we meet resistance, we more so will meet great souls who will hail us, love us, and guide us, and we will know them when they appear. Ours is not the task of fixing the entire world all at once, but of stretching out to mend the part of the world that is within our reach. Any small, calm thing that one soul can do to help another soul, to assist some portion of this poor, suffering world, will help immensely. It is not given to us to know which acts or by whom will cause the critical mass to tip towards an enduring good. What is needed for dramatic change is an accumulation of acts, adding, adding to, adding more, continuing. We know that it does not take everyone on earth to bring justice and peace, but only a small, determined group who will not give up during the first, second, or hundredth gale. One of the most calming and powerful actions you can do to intervene in a stormy world is to stand up and show your soul. Soul on deck shines like gold in dark times. The light of the soul throws sparks, can send up flares, build signal fires, causes proper matters to catch fire. To display the lantern of soul in shadowy times like these, to be fierce and to show mercy toward others, both are acts of immense bravery and greatest necessity. Struggling souls catch light from other souls that are fully lit
and willing to show it. If you would help to calm the tumult, this is the strongest thing you can do. There will always be times when you feel discouraged. I, too, have felt despair many times in my life, but I do not keep a chair for it. I will not entertain it. It is not allowed to eat from my plate. I hope you will write this on your wall. When a great ship is in harbor and moored, it is safe. There can be no doubt. But that is not what great ships are built for. We were made for these times. Estes wrote those words in 2004. Though they've been, not surprisingly, resurrected many times in recent days. In these same recent days when so many have found themselves struggling, myself included, I found myself struggling with the pain I feel in those around me. I found myself struggling with the fear so alive among my friends to the south. I found myself struggling with the uncertainty of not knowing what to do, what I can do. I have found myself knocked from my moorings, adrift on tides that seem to be shaking me to and fro. For I have always been anchored by a faith that what is most divine is our interdependence, how we are inextricably tied one to another and to all. And that anchor seems sometimes to me to be losing its hold. And yet I know that we, the Unitarian Universalist community, we were made for these times. We were made for these times because we are a people of covenant, not creed, able to see past brokenness to the healing that will come, knowing that we are ever and always in relationship and called back to covenant when it is broken. We acknowledge that there is not one right answer. Indeed, there may be many. Committee meetings and coffee hour have taught me that in every church I've ever visited. We are called to the broadest global community and the rights of every individual within that community, to honor their worth and dignity while demanding respect for all. Indeed, we were made for these times. We gather today to talk about the United Nations and the Unitarian Universalist office therein. Today, in fact, is UN Children's Day, so I'm deeply appreciative of the story Fade told this morning. And as much as this may seem like a distant issue from our current context, thinking on the United Nations over the past week has been a balm to my soul. I've taken comfort in knowing that the United Nations had started to form in 1939, just after war had been declared by the British. That it had started to form not in a time of peace, but in the midst of war, knowing that if peace were to come at the end, that it would need a place to gather. I've taken comfort in knowing that the UN is, like our own tradition, informed by the universal and the particular, that the sovereignty of nations is not unlike the polity of our churches, that we might freely form an association in order to work together, but that how we do that work responds not to directive from above, but from the voices of those within. And I have taken comfort in knowing that the UN is no more a perfect institution than we are, but that they operate as though all the countries were together in covenant. As conflict arises, they return to the table time and again, and with the support of the wider community, the connections are rebuilt. Forgiveness is sought. The covenant is formed anew. I've taken comfort in the existence of the United Nations, and I have been reminded of how badly we need to return to it again. The focus of the UUUNO Spring Institute this year was on the costs and consequences of the racialization of poverty, the ways in which poverty is written onto the bodies of black and brown people all over the world. It emerged out of numerous studies that said that not only are there enormous gaps between the wealth of developed and developing nations, between the rich and poor within those nations, those gaps are widening every year. In the United States, between 2005 and 2009, a four-year period, inflation-adjusted median wealth fell by 66% among Hispanic households and by 53% among African American households. According to the federal government in Vancouver, more than 58% of people living in poverty were racialized persons. And this number doesn't include Indigenous or First Nations people. The number of racialized families in Toronto, where I come from, who were living in poverty increased by 362% from 1980 to 2000. And according to the community activist group, The Color of Poverty, the numbers have only gotten worse in this jobless recovery. In British Columbia, each year since 2014, we have seen a record number of children living in poverty, with an increasing proportion of families of single women of color. It is quite simply a tragedy. It is a travesty, and I saw it in my work in Toronto at every turn, working with immigrants and refugees and community activists on campaigns for poverty reduction. I saw it in my work with Kosovar refugees when they arrived in Kingston. I saw it when I traveled to Ghana to work with the Women's Empowerment Program. And I saw it most acutely when I lived in Northern Ontario, off-reserve in Moosonee, a very long snowmobile ride away from Attawapiskat. The conditions in that remote northern community brought special condemnation from the UN's Rapporteur on Indigenous Affairs, who declared the situation dire after a visit in 2011. Homes with holes in the walls whipped by snowy wind at 40 degrees below. In April of this year, 18 children attempted suicide in a community of just 2,000. The great and growing gap in wealth that plagues the world beyond our borders is just as alive within it. And too often, I find myself sitting paralyzed, not knowing what to do. For too long now, I have found myself focused on finding the right solution, the right answer, as though there were but one. I found myself judging the actions of others harshly, naming all the ways in which their way is doomed to failure, rather than contributing my own energy and my own ideas to make it better. And I have judged myself harshly, too, for not acting, for not doing enough, for not being either compassionate or simply passionate enough. I judge myself for not having fixed it yet. And I felt hopeless in the face of it all, even when we make progress. Perhaps some of these things ring true for you too, these things that sit heavy in our hearts. This month's theme at first has proven to be a blessing to me in my reflections, letting go. The practice of setting limits and finding freedom. Sitting with it, sitting where I am, sitting with where many of us may be, this theme has invited three goals. One, let go. In the words of the recently departed and so beloved poet Leonard Cohen, ring the bells that still can ring, forget your perfect offering. Let go of our need for a perfect response. Instead, ring the bells that still can ring. Set limits on what each of us is responsible for. I cannot fix the whole of everything alone, neither can you. In our churches, in our institutions like the UN, we are better when we are together. As S. has said, ours is not the task of fixing the entire world all at once, but of stretching out to mend the part of the world that is within our reach. Know that the answer we find may be ours to enact, and others will find their own answers. We are compelled by our faith to see one another as free individuals, not to write our truth upon another. Shall I give money to the people standing on the median at Blanchard and Hillside, from dawn to darkness, each day a new person claiming the spot, hoping to earn a meal? Yes. Shall I give money to organizations that support the homeless and the working poor, whether they offer direct services like clothing and shelter or work to change policy and legislation? Yes. Shall I vote for those who make economic justice a priority, who recognize its racialized nature, who support a living wage or a guaranteed minimum income? Both of which were named as priority recommendations coming out of that spring seminar? Yes.
I'm going to try to ring the bells that I can ring. And I'm going to work to get past the positivist enlightenment project that lives deep within me, that tells me that there is a right answer for how to do this, and that if I just think about it long enough and hard enough, true enough, that I will find it. I struggle often with the golden rule, that religious and philosophical tenet that we should do unto others as we would have done unto ourselves. The reason I find it challenging is that it sits so squarely in line with that enlightenment project that puts each of us at the center with the answer and not in relationship and dialogue. Do to other people what I would want done to me. Works fine if I think what other people want is the same thing that I want. What if they don't? What if what they want, what they need, how they see the solution is completely different? What if their context demands something else to work? The answer is not simply to act. The answer is not simply not to act, to be paralyzed again. The answer is to see each exchange as relationship, which demands of us something better than the golden rule. And we've decided that that better thing is platinum. So I offer the platinum rule: do unto others as they would have you do unto them. Do unto others as they would have you do unto them. Let others be at the center of their action. It is the heart of self-determination. This platinum rule sits in the core of our UU principles, seeking world community, honoring individual worth, and seeing the whole as interconnected. The United Nations is much the same, where countries make covenants and commitments without everyone being forced to do it the same way, recognizing that in our diversity there is great strength. The UN is no perfect offering, neither is Unitarian Universalism. Mine will not be a perfect offering either, but I will seek to offer what I can into the whole, to make smaller the gap between those who have and those who have not. What offering might you make, near or far, imperfect though it will be? Blessed be. Our choir sang to us earlier, "In the glow of candlelight, all of the world comes together tonight." Except they sang day. "And in the glow of the candles we see peace for you and peace for me. And with our candles and with the light, we hold a symbol, a beacon in the night." Clarissa Pinkola Estes said to us, "You are a great ship. Staying moored in harbor is not what you were made for." And you sang to one another, "The ocean refuses, no river. Take your light upon your river, a great ship, into that wide ocean. We will meet you there." Blessed be.